Today is Wednesday, March 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. UN human rights officials raise additional concerns over crackdowns in Myanmar.
Where the state fails to protect the human rights, or where the state is carrying out human rights violations against its own people, it is the duty of the international community to do something about it.
Plus, North Korea issues a warning to the United States.
Washington has tried reaching out to Pyongyang, but has received no response.
And a look at one South African documentary headed to the Oscars. We'll have these stories and more next. Local media in Myanmar on Tuesday reported that thousands of residents fled an industrial suburb of the country's commercial capital amid fears of further bloodshed. This, after dozens were killed in anti-coup protests over the weekend there and martial law was declared. Residents said that security forces maintained a heavy presence in the industrial zone of Phlang Thayar, Yangon, where more than 40 people were killed on Sunday and several factories were set ablaze. After the violence, authorities shut down mobile internet access across the country, making information difficult to verify. Reuters' Emily Wither brings us this story of a funeral of a young student who died during a crackdown in Yangon's outskirts on Sunday, the bloodiest day of the protests.
A medical student who will now never graduate. The 17-year-old is the latest protester to lose his life in a brutal crackdown on anti-coup protesters in Myanmar. Friends and family sang revolutionary songs as they paid their final respects. Kant Nya Hain lost his life on the outskirts of the capital Yangon on Sunday. Now the bloodiest day of the protests since the February 1st military coup against elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Security forces shot dead at least 20 people on Monday after 74 were killed a day earlier. Many in a Yangon suburb where Chinese-financed factories were torched. The Chinese embassy said many Chinese staff were injured and trapped in arson attacks by unidentified assailants and called on Myanmar to protect Chinese property and citizens. China is viewed as being supportive of the military junta that has taken power. Now, some of those that don't support the military government and its increasingly brutal crackdown are fleeing into neighboring India. Among them is Chor, a fireman who said he and 20 others joined the protesters after refusing police orders.
On February 18th, we received an order from the military that the fire truck, which is red in color, had to be painted white, which is the color of the police. The fire truck was going to be used for dispersing crowds. On that particular day, on February 18th, I was the commander, and I went to disperse the crowd, but I didn't fulfill my orders. We didn't want to be under the control of the military, so we joined the civil disobedience movement.
He's now in India's Mizoram state, where Reuters has also spoken to police defectors who say they refused to shoot civilians. A spokesman for the junta could not be reached for comment. According to an Indian police officer in Mizoram, more than 400 people from Myanmar, many of them policemen, have fled there since late February. India's federal government has ordered local authorities to stop the influx.
Reuters reporter Emily Wither. Human rights officials are expressing alarm at the soaring death toll in Myanmar as the military junta's security forces intensify their brutal crackdown on protesters. Lisa Schlein has that part of the story.
The past week has been particularly deadly. The UN Human Rights Office says 11 people were killed on Monday and 57 over the weekend by security forces that used live ammunition against peaceful protesters. Since February 1st, when Myanmar's military toppled the democratically elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi, the UN agency confirms at least 149 people have been killed, though it says it believes the number of deaths to be be much higher. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says her agency continues to receive distressing reports of people being arbitrarily arrested, forcibly disappeared, and brutally beaten and tortured while in detention. By last count, she says, more than 2,084 people remain arbitrarily detained.
At least 37 journalists have been arrested, of whom 19 remain in arbitrary detention. At least 5 deaths in custody have occurred in recent weeks, and at least 2 victims' bodies have shown signs of severe physical abuse, indicating that they were tortured.
A day after Sunday's deadly crackdown on protesters, Myanmar's military authorities declared martial law in a number of townships in and around Yangon and Mandalay. That means military law now will apply to civilians, subjecting offenders to military tribunals that give them no right of appeal. Many countries and human rights activists have been calling for economic sanctions and an arms embargo on Myanmar's military coup leaders. Shamdasani dismisses Myanmar's claims that under international law, countries have no right to interfere in its internal affairs. She says that is an argument often raised by countries where serious human rights situations are occurring.
Where the state fails to protect the human rights, or where the state is carrying out human rights violations against its own people, it is the duty of the international community to do something about it, to take measures to bring the violence to an end, to take measures to ensure accountability. You cannot argue non-interference when you are shooting your own people.
Human rights officials are calling on the military to stop killing and detaining protesters. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet is appealing to all those with influence to take measures to bring an end to the state violence against the Myanmar people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
North Korea has issued new threats against the United States and South Korea. Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of ruler Kim Jong-un, said in an official media statement, the two allies could face consequences for conducting annual joint military exercises. Remarks come as top American foreign policy and defense officials hold talks with partners this week in Northeast Asia. Jason Strother takes it from here.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin wrapped up security talks Tuesday in Tokyo. They met with Japan's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Toshimitsu Motegi, and Defense Minister Nobuo Kishi. During a press event, Secretary Blinken said Washington has tried reaching out to Pyongyang, but has received no response.
As you know, the North Korea policy is under review. We're looking at whether various additional pressure measures could be effective, whether there are diplomatic paths that make sense. All of that is under review, and it's under review in close consultation with our allies and partners.
The U.S. officials will travel Wednesday to Seoul, where North Korea's nuclear weapons program is expected to be high on the agenda. Blinken and Austin are also trying to reaffirm a counterbalance to China's influence in the region. The defense secretary says Beijing's increased aggression in disputed waters is a threat to both the U.S. and Japan.
I know Japan shares our concerns with China's destabilizing actions. And as I have said before, China is a pacing challenge for the Department of Defense. And we know that competing in today's shifting global dynamics can only be done through the spirit of teamwork and cooperation, which are the hallmarks of our alliance with Japan.
Foreign Minister Motegi says Tokyo's position on China is the same as Washington's. We agreed to oppose China's unilateral bid to change the status quo in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, Motegi said. A recent White House strategy paper named China as the biggest threat to America's interests. Robert Dujaric, co-director of the Institute for Contemporary Asian Studies at Temple University's Tokyo campus, tells VOA that strengthening partnerships in the Pacific is one way to put pressure on China.
Beijing would prefer the relationship between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea to be bad because they don't want their adversaries to work closely together, but there's not much they can do.
But Washington is leaving the door open for dialogue with Beijing. Following talks in South Korea, Secretary Blinken will depart for Anchorage, Alaska, to meet with senior Chinese foreign policy officials. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
The U.S. Office of the Director of National Intelligence released a report Tuesday that found no evidence that foreign actors changed votes or significantly disrupted the 2020 presidential election. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden explains the report's key findings.
The report basically summarizes a lot of what the U.S. intelligence community has been saying going back for months and in some cases even years about the threat of foreign interference in U.S. elections, especially in U.S. presidential elections. The report says that there were a number of foreign actors that were intent and in some ways tried to influence the U.S. election. The top among them, the two key ones, are Russia, which used a number of means, methods to influence U.S. voters, including, in some cases, according to the report, using people within the circle of then-President Donald Trump to portray and spread a Russian narrative to U.S. voters. And also Iran, which used various methods, including some hacking and intimidation tactics to try to convince voters not to vote for Trump and to vote for Biden instead, because Iran did not want to see Trump win re-election. One thing that a former senior CIA official told me, Paul Pilar, who's now at Georgetown, he was telling me that the biggest takeaway is that Russia really felt it got its money's worth in 2016 and just kind of piggybacked on that. And that despite all the talk about how the Trump administration took a hard line on Russia, Russia saw its investment in the policies espoused and what in the actions of President Trump is, you know, everything they could have hoped for. So those were the main findings. But interestingly, it said that after looking at all the evidence, it concluded that China, which had been put out there repeatedly by the Trump administration as perhaps the greatest threat in terms of influencing the election, actually sat the election out and concluded it wasn't worth the risk and the possible repercussions of trying to push one candidate over the other.
Jeff, as you mentioned, there had been ample concern put out by the intelligence community before the 2020 presidential election. This report seems to corroborate that. So where do things go from here?
Well, that's a good question. There are going to be questions about how the intelligence community was presenting information, perhaps, depending on the political point of view, how it may have been viewed or used by the previous administration. Again, you had top intelligence officials, including Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe under President Trump, saying China's the biggest threat. China's trying to interfere with the election. And the overwhelming view of the intelligence community is that simply did not happen. There is a minority view that said that China did have some efforts to try to sway people in favor perhaps of Biden during the summer, but that is an assessment that was made by one intelligence office with moderate confidence, whereas the overall view about China was with high confidence. So what role does the U.S. intelligence community have in this? And then what will U.S. adversaries try in the future?
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. New Delhi was found to be the world's worst polluted capital for the third straight year in 2020. Indian cities made up 35 of the top 50 urban areas with the worst air quality, according to a new study. Reuters reporter Adam Reed has more.
Swiss group IQ Air conducted the study that measures air quality levels based on the concentration of lung-damaging airborne particles. The 2020 World Air Quality Report placed 35 Indian cities inside the top 50 most polluted cities, based on data it gathered from 106 countries. India as a whole emerged from the report as the world's third most polluted country overall, behind only Bangladesh and Pakistan. That's despite an 11% reduction in the annual average for the damaging particle PM2.5 due to coronavirus lockdown measures. The burning of crops in the neighbouring state of Punjab contributed to toxic air returning to New Delhi in November to levels that exceeded the World Health Organization's annual exposure guideline by more than 14 times. Further information published in partnership with Greenpeace Southeast Asia found that air pollution caused an estimated 54,000 premature deaths in New Delhi last year.
Reuters, Adam Reed. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. supermassive black holes have masses that are millions to billions of times that of our own sun and are mostly found sitting at the center of galaxies. Some scientists theorize these monster black holes can travel through space. They just haven't been able to prove it. A new study led by the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard and Smithsonian, provides evidence of a supermassive black hole moving through space. The research team studied 10 supermassive black holes. Of the 10, they found 9 of the giant black holes are comfortable sitting still. But they did find one at the center of a galaxy some 230 million light years away that appeared to be moving. While they don't know what causes it to move, they suspect that it could either be the recoil of a new black hole formed by a merger, or it could be part of a binary system of supermassive black holes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Israeli Defense Ministry says it has completed an upgrade of the country's Iron Dome rocket defense system to cope with an additional array of aerial threats. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The Iron Dome was developed to intercept short-ranged unguided rockets and has shot down some 2,500 incoming projectiles fired from the Gaza Strip since it was deployed a decade ago. Officials say the system is now capable of intercepting missile salvos and drones. The Iron Dome is part of Israel's multi-layered aerial defense system, ranging from systems capable of intercepting rockets fired from short range up to striking long-range missiles outside of the atmosphere. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Europe's medical regulator, the European Medicines Agency, says it will announce on Thursday its findings on the safety of AstraZeneca's coronavirus vaccine as more European Union countries suspend its use over fears it might be linked to blood clots. Critics say governments are putting politics over science. Lisa Bryant has that story.
The European Medicines Agency's executive director, Emer Cook, says for now, the regulator stands behind its conclusion the AstraZeneca vaccine is safe, even as its experts conduct a thorough safety review. The AstraZeneca vaccine has been injected into millions of arms, with just a few reported cases of blood clots, and it's uncertain if they're linked to the shot.
We need to have the facts first. We cannot come to a conclusion until we've done a thorough scientific analysis, and we owe it to the European citizens to deliver this clear and science-based response.
The Medicines Agency, or EMA, has also tapped international experts for its review, which will also look at whether certain specific batches could be problematic. Scientists will also look at chances of blood clots with other COVID-19 vaccines beyond AstraZeneca's.
At present, there is no indication that vaccination has caused these conditions. They have not come up in the clinical trials, and they're not listed as known or expected side events with this vaccine.
But increasingly, European Union governments are taking no chances. Sweden and Latvia are among the latest to join more than a dozen EU countries to temporarily halt their AstraZeneca rollouts.
Je souhaite ardemment que nous puissions reprendre le plus vite et le plus tôt possible.
Here in France, which suspended the shot Monday, Health Minister Olivier Véran said he hoped the AstraZeneca vaccine campaign will quickly resume, pending a positive EMA ruling. Véran himself received the AstraZeneca inoculation, and he told French citizens who have done likewise not to worry. The World Health Organization also recommends AstraZeneca, pending evidence to the contrary. Dozens of countries have authorized its use, although the United States has yet to do so. And AstraZeneca still has EU champions. Belgium, for example, argues suspending the vaccine's rollout would be irresponsible.
Ça va pas simplifier la vie des médecins généralistes.
That's also the view of many French medical experts. Dr. Jean-Pierre Hameau, honorary president of the French Doctors Federation, told French TV the decision to suspend the vaccine's use reflected political rather than medical considerations.
National governments are afraid of safety concerns, but at the same time, I'm not convinced that this is the right way to go about it.
Simona Guagliardo is an analyst at the Brussels-based European Policy Center.
I wonder what could be the damage. I mean, in the public opinion, people are already scared, and I'm afraid that this might scare them off even more.
The vaccine suspensions couldn't come at a worse time for the EU, with some member states hit by a third wave of the pandemic. Italy is again under lockdown. France and Germany may follow shortly. And suspending the shots use may further delay the EU's much-criticized vaccine rollout that sees the 27-member bloc lagging behind countries like the United States, Israel, Bahrain, and even ex-member Britain, which has jabbed millions in the UK with the AstraZeneca shot. While acknowledging mistakes, EU officials also blame some of the problems on production delays by AstraZeneca itself. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
While the COVID-19 pandemic continues to affect most of the planet, there has been a growing effort to distribute pandemic resources and especially vaccines in a fair way among all the peoples of the world, whether they be rich or poor. To learn more about the ethical shifts in the aid and philanthropic communities, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Thomas J. Boyke, Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics, and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also the coordinator of the Council's Independent Task Force on Preparing for the Next Pandemic.
You see it domestically in the United States that a big focus of the incoming Biden administration has been around equity in terms of how we address the pandemic. That's a response to what we saw in the early months, where you saw terribly inequitable outcomes for Black and Latino populations and Native American populations.
What's another example that signifies that the shift toward equity and inclusion is coming into its own?
A small example, but it gives you some indication. I work for the Council on Foreign Relations. It's a 100-year-old institution, normally very concerned just on foreign affairs and foreign policy. But when we did our task force on pandemic preparedness, it was a lot around equity, both domestically and globally. And that is not normally the kind of thing that ends up in a Council on Foreign Relations report. So thinking about these social issues and what we can do for disadvantaged populations, I think is a greater concern.
I know a lot of the biggest action toward equity in the world is through COVAX. Would you tell us what that is in a nutshell?
So COVAX is part of a larger initiative organized by the World Health Organization to accelerate therapeutics, so medicines, diagnostics, and vaccines to the countries and people that would need it in this crisis. People need to remember this was a novel virus, meaning it's brand new. So there were no effective treatments to get it, not medicines, not vaccines, not diagnostics. All of that had to be developed in response to this virus emerging. What this program was meant to do was try to spur along that development and then rapidly try to accelerate its distribution globally. COVAX, the piece that's dedicated to vaccines, is done by the World Health Organization and a couple of other international NGOs, and it's the one that has gotten the most money and had the most success of those three parts of this larger initiative. And it was built on the fly. There was no COVAX before this crisis began. They had built it in the midst of the crisis over the past year, and they deserve some credit for what it has done so far.
So would you say that global vaccine equity is primarily only a job for international actors, governments, NGOs, the UN, et cetera?
A lot of what we need to see around equity, of course, has to occur at the domestic level. It's about having health systems that can address the needs of vulnerable populations, programs to support them undertaking the measures that you have to in a pandemic, things that people had never thought about before, but now you do, like being able to isolate, access to masks, or being able to get access to healthcare and be diagnosed early. All of these things drove the inequity, not just in the United States, but other nations. We need to plan for being able to do that in advance. The reality of pandemics is that they put a mirror to societies. pandemics show us the collective risks that arise from not having healthcare systems that address the broader needs of the population and leave our most vulnerable exposed.
What are some of the vulnerable populations you're talking about?
Like migrant workers. So if you look at Singapore, its resurgence of cases happened within its migrant worker population. If you look at the United States, we saw outbreaks among essential workers without access to healthcare or an economic means to take the measures to protect themselves. This is what really has been driving the pandemic. And if we're not able to protect the most vulnerable and disadvantaged amongst us, there is a collective risk that makes all of us less safe.
Thomas J. Boyke is a senior fellow for global health, economics, and development at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. A dissident band of Roman Catholic priests leading a disobedience campaign against the Vatican said on Tuesday they would carry on blessing same-sex couples in defiance of church orders. Reuters' Jillian Kitchener.
In some countries, parishes and ministers have begun blessing same-sex unions in lieu of marriage, setting off alarm bells among church conservatives. That led to Monday's ruling, backed by Pope Francis, which greatly disappointed gay Catholics. Now, an Austrian-based group known as the Parish Priest Initiative is fighting back. In a Tuesday statement, the group said they were deeply appalled by the new decree and that, quote, this is a relapse into times that we had hoped to have overcome with Pope Francis. We will, in solidarity with so many, not reject any loving couple in the future who ask to celebrate God's blessing, which they experience every day, also in a worship service. The rebel group, led by Father Helmut Schuller, has long been a thorn in the side of the Vatican. The group, now with 350 members from the ranks of the official church, also wants rules changed so that priests can marry and women can become priests.
Reuters reporter Jillian Kitchener. And finally, My Octopus Teacher, an underwater documentary about the touching but bittersweet relationship between a man and an octopus. As its director is feeling sky high after its nomination for an Oscar in the Best Feature Documentary category, reporter Vicky Stark sat down with one of the directors.
Papa Ehrlich co-directed her first feature film with James Reed. It's about their fellow filmmaker, Craig Foster, who befriends an octopus and visits her every day. He also gets to know her home, which is part of a great African sea forest in the Atlantic Ocean. Ehrlich says she watched the Oscars announcement last night.
Oh, I feel like I'm just coming back down to Earth right now, 24 hours later. At the time, I jumped so high. I think I was higher than the table that my laptop was on.
She says the movie, which took 10 years to make and was eventually picked up by Netflix, has already bagged at least 20 international awards from various mainstream and environmental festivals.
The most amazing part of this film is the reach that it's got and the responses that we've received from people all over the world really just resonated with what we were trying to say. Yeah, so all of this is really just the cherry on top of the cake, but we are very, very grateful, very excited.
Ehrlich says the movie has done wonders for the non-profit organization she and Foster work for called the Sea Change Project. It's aimed at protecting the kelp forest, which runs along the coast of South Africa and Namibia and is under threat from climate change. She says they received many donations from the public, allowing them to continue the work they love.
So we really are just focused on doing what we do, which is to get into the kelp forest every day and record what we see and make this place a global icon and an ecosystem that everyone all over the world is invested in protecting.
My Octopus Teacher is up against Collective, Crip Camp, The Mole Agent, and Time. The winner will be announced at the 93rd Academy Awards ceremony on the 25th of April. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.